Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Frontier Beyond Fear Blog Talk Radio broadcast and podcast, broadcasting live right now from the beautiful Pacific Northwest, where I'm once again looking out on misty forests this morning. We have our typical weather for this time of year, although we are starting to see the sun more often, and I have come to appreciate the mists. There is a beauty in the mists, and perhaps that concept will also be relevant to the conversation that I'm about to have with a wonderful returning guest who I am so delighted to bring back on the broadcast, and that is Dr. Alan Hunter. Now, Alan was on the show, I guess, a little over a month ago, or maybe about 2 months ago, and today, he's going to talk about his new book, Gratitude and Beyond, Five Insights for a Fulfilled Life, which I know is going to be a wonderful continuation of the discussion we had last time, which went into many aspects of our life's journey. So I'm very much looking forward to this. The author of several inspirational books, Alan has a PhD in English literature from Oxford University, and he currently teaches at the Blue Hills Writing Institute at Curry College in Massachusetts. He also regularly inspires people through his counseling, and he is a highly spiritual author that has shared a great depth of insight in many books. And I'll mention just a couple this time, because last time I practically overflowed my intro time just by talking about all the many books the very prolific Dr. Hunter has written. One that he has written that I am really enjoying right now is Write Your Memoir, The Soul Work of Telling Your Story. And I hope that'll be a topic of an upcoming show. And then another that is also quite recent is Spiritual Hunger, Integrating Myth and Ritual into Daily Life, which I also happen to have but have not yet read, and I'm really looking forward to it. And last time, if you missed the last show, I highly encourage you to listen. We talked about his book, The Path of Synchronicity, Align Yourself with Your Life's Flow. Now, Alan's website is up on the show page today. If you do click on it, be sure you open it in a different window so you don't leave the show. I like to advise you of that. And that site is simply alanhunter.net, so he's very easy to find. So without further delay, I am just so happy to bring back on the show the inspirational Dr. Alan Hunter. Welcome back, Alan.
Oh, Susan, it's so lovely to be chatting with you again. I did so enjoy the last time.
Well, thank you. I have to say that it really touches my heart when the conversations just flow so naturally. And last time, we touched on so many fascinating things related to our journeys. And so I really am looking forward to learning more about your new book, because I think that the topic of fulfillment is, of course, an elusive one for many of us. And I'm especially intrigued by how gratitude is the gateway.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could launch this discussion with that.
Well, very happily, and I have to say that gratitude is a wonderful place to be in, and it is only the first of these five insights that I look at in the book. And I also have to say that it's based on a very personal experience, and that is I had many years ago what I can only describe as a serious brush with death. And as a result of that, I was, of course, grateful that I continued to exist and continued to live. But it wasn't until I really took the time, years later, to look at that experience and say, wait, what was going on there? What was really happening? That I found that gratitude, wonderful as it is, really is a gateway through which we can pass in order to find four more very important insights that can completely change the way we see ourselves and the way we run our lives. So this comes from a very powerful personal experience and from the fact that just like everybody in the world, we are prone to go through life's traumas and dramas, and afterwards we dust ourselves off and we say, oh, well, thank goodness that's over, and we forget part of the lesson. And so in writing the book, I was exploring these lessons that I knew were there, but which I hadn't fully articulated in total before. And so that was really the motivation behind writing about the five insights.
You know, I find, and I think that this is important to note as well, because I know there are so many of us who are being called to write, is that what's
yes.
interesting about what you share, Alan, is how the very exercise of writing really reveals our soul to us. I know that you have said this, and it's not simply writing. It's an actual integrated part of the journey, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It's hard to overstress this, but I think perhaps the easiest way to say it is that lots of people, especially you know those people I've counseled over the years, they can talk a good line about things.
Mm-hmm.
And then fail to actually carry that through into life. And what happens when we write about our lives is, it's very interesting to me, it's a sort of mysterious way in which it becomes, our words become more real to us, and we have to look at them and say, oh, did I just write that? Well, here it is on the page, you know, I guess I did. And
yeah.
that is a real recognition. It's the difference between perhaps knowing something in your head, theoretically, and then knowing it in your heart when you say, oh yes, that was me, I was there, I did that, oh my goodness. And that is real profound knowing, where sometimes the things we know in our heads are perhaps easily discarded, or more easily
yeah.
discarded.
It seems like it's almost like not only being introduced to ourselves, but becoming intimate friends with who we are, or maybe
yes.
not even friends. Isn't that true, Alan? That sometimes when we have to work through some things when we write about our journeys, because you know, we may be judgmental.
Yes.
In fact, that's often the case, isn't it? Where we're self-judgmental, and you know, when you talk about gratitude, it's not always an easy place to find. I mean, I think especially when you think about your journey, there can be aspects that are very challenging. And, you know,
yes.
when you talk about in your book the major shocks that wake us up, for example, sometimes it's challenging to become, to get into a space of gratitude about those things, since they can be very traumatic, just being
yes.
in shock. And I wonder, I would really like to hear more about your near-death experience, but also about, you know, how do we even begin to approach this place of gratitude for those things that are so challenging?
Oh, yes. Well, this is exactly it, you see. If we take my somewhat undramatic near-death experience, I was very, very ill with lung and breathing problems, and I was living in England at the time, and the doctors there, the National Health Service, it's all free, you know, but they couldn't work out what was wrong with me. And eventually I said, well, this is not working, I can't walk from my desk to the door without pausing because I can't breathe. And a friend of mine said, well, you know, have you tried acupuncture? And in those days, in England, acupuncture was really wild and out there.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, well, I'll give it a try. And God bless these folks. They took me took me in, and it wasn't until later that they said to me, well, you know, we've only ever had one person as bad as you, and he lived also.
Oh, my.
I mean, at the time, I thought they were just being nice to me when they said, oh, do sit down and have a cup of tea. But I discovered later they weren't just being nice. They were afraid I was going to fall over, for one thing. I was turning blue because I couldn't breathe. And they had already taken or tried to take my pulse and realized that my pulse was too weak to measure. So they spent 45 minutes giving me tea so I was warm enough and my pulse was strong enough so that they could take a reading. And that was what they told me later. At the time, I thought I was just a little bit floaty. Actually, I was hovering right there on the edge of ceasing to exist. I wasn't afraid. I wasn't panicked. I just felt this was all a bit of a pity. Anyway, once they got to work at me, yeah, it was strange because at the time... Sorry?
Well, I was going to say your story, just so you know, parallels one that someone else told on this show about drowning, who actually became very close to drowning. The same floaty feeling, which he also described, it's the oxygen deprivation. I mean, that's the physical cause, but you were essentially drowning.
Yes, I was completely starved of necessary oxygen. I just couldn't breathe.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, they were the people who were working on me knew this, but they were so kind, they didn't panic me. In fact, they didn't tell me until several weeks later when I was already well on my way to recovery.
Yeah.
And it really, one of the things that kept me from examining why I was literally drowning is shame. And I say that because the reason I had this illness and the reason it became so serious was that I was at a point in my life when I was being inauthentic to myself. I was trying too hard to keep my employers happy in a job that I really wasn't that good at. I was working with disturbed children, and I was good at it, but I wasn't as good as I thought I ought to be. And I thought I had to keep my then fiancé happy. She didn't have a job, and I thought I had to make that relationship work. Just me, I had to make it work.
Yeah.
And so I had taken on that responsibility. I thought I had to make my parents happy because they weren't particularly thrilled with my choice of work or my choice of fiancé. I thought that I had to make everything work. And of course, my body said, you're nuts, you're crazy. And started to shut down on me as a way of saying, if you keep on doing this, you will destroy yourself. So yes, it was an organic illness, but it was also something that my body, my mind, my soul was saying, you have to wake up and pay attention to this.
Yeah.
Because I was so ashamed of having been so so selfish and thinking that I could solve everything, I didn't really want to look at this after I started to get better. I was really rather sad that I'd been so foolish. And so when I started to write the book, it took an effort of will and humility to say,
yeah,
I really do need to look at this because actually, even if it hurts a lot, it's necessary. So that's rather a long way around to say that this is what brought me to the place of writing about this experience so that I could discover the five insights and live from that place rather than the other ego-centered place.
You know, I know it's somewhat a ways around, and yet there's a great depth of insight in what you just said that I sense a lot of people can relate to because... And I can relate to it. In fact, I still go through some of this so-called foolishness. I can see it as that. And, you know, a lot of times we know it. We know it even while we're in it. And what I see in part of what you just told me is this inclination that so many have that we have to please others, please others. And in doing so, we completely sabotage not only the path to truly pleasing those we need to please, but most importantly, ourselves.
Exactly.
And you talk about a physical blockage that was a reflection of your energetic. I mean, I guess that's the word I would. You know, there was an energetic, an etheric. It was both physical.
Yes.
Like you said, it manifested in the physical. And yet, you know, when you talk about it being a difficult thing to talk about, you know what, Alan? Mm-hmm. I just so relate to it. And I'll just bet many people listening out there right now and to the podcast are going to relate to this too and feel like, oh, my goodness, I've been foolish in the same way. And in fact, I'm being foolish that way right now. More than I would like. And so I wanted to say that to you right at the outset. It's one of the hardest things in confronting our authentic selves, and yet...
Isn't it? Yes.
We're all on this path, it seems, many of us. So without any more mystery, I'm going to allow you to unfold these insights in the way that you would choose, because it would be really easy to just ask you, well, what are the five insights? But I'm going to leave that up to you, how you choose to reveal them to us on this journey through your book.
Well, I'd be very happy to do that, because if we take, the reason I wrote this book, starting from such a personal point of view, is for exactly the reasons that you've just spelled out, that I suspect, mm-hmm. in fact, I know I'm not the only one who's made these mistakes of trying to live to please others, of trying to seem something that I'm not. And so I think people can take away from this, many people could take away from this, some really important life lessons.
Yeah.
And, when I found myself still alive after all this time, suffering with this inability to breathe, when I found I was getting better, I knew I had to change something. I was profoundly grateful for still being alive, for being able to breathe much better than I had for several months. And then I realized a little later, what is it that happens when one is grateful? One of the things that happens is, and specifically for me, I had been living my life in order to please my ego, my poor, wounded, damaged ego that wanted to be reassured that it was effective, that I was effective. And when I felt gratitude for still being alive, the sense was, I guess there's still something I have to do that I haven't finished. I felt that very strongly. And once I felt that as the first aspect of gratitude, the second aspect, the second insight, came very naturally, because I discovered that when one realizes, I'm here for a purpose that I haven't finished yet, and these people have helped me to stay alive, the second insight is what I call humility. You can't be in the ego space anymore in the same way. It just doesn't work. And in fact, in the course of the book is structured around these five insights, each one of which takes away some of that wounded, damaged ego that we all have and replaces it with something else. And the first thing that happened was, after gratitude, was insight number two, was the sense of humility. It's not all about me. It's about something else, and I'm not sure what it is.
Uh-huh.
And it enabled me to be open, I call it being broken open, to all the goodness that was around me. I thought I was broken, so I had to pretend to be someone I wasn't. In fact, I discovered that by doing that, I was broken open to this sense of, I am not quite as important as I had thought, or even remotely as important as I'd thought, but I do have a purpose. And that was the insight of humility. And I think that's a really, really big one on the way forward.
You know, when you're talking about this, Alan, it seems like this is an area that is often misunderstood very easily, especially within, and using this term very broadly, New Age circles. I hate to use that term, but people know what I'm talking about when I say that often, is we confuse, you know, utterly diminishing ourselves in a way that's unhealthy, you know, that is lack of any esteem whatsoever, which can be an unhealthy path, versus humility. There is a really delicate distinction. And, you know, one of the things that I've been working with, Alan, and I know some of the people listening to this show as well, is having come from a conservative Christian path, this concept of being broken, this concept of being in a space of humility and gratitude is very important on that path. And, you know, I'm seeking, and I think many of us are seeking, ways to integrate multiple threads of our spiritual experience into our understanding. And I'm seeing kind of an interesting gateway in what you just said. That comes from that path as well. Again, when you don't totally diminish yourself, and yet find that place. And it's very hard to describe, isn't it? Because I'm not sure I've found it yet either, but I can begin to glimpse it. Let's just put it that way.
Well, it's one of the, again, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I call these the five insights, and it's not a one-shot deal. We have to remind ourselves of it every day. We have to say, oh, you know, I am grateful. And wait a second, make sure that humility is available. Make sure that I'm not getting too caught up in the me world.
Right.
It's a daily practice. So, yes, I hear what you say.
How do you still value yourself? You know, here's another area that gets tricky for me. When we talk about the ego, and I may ask you to actually define the ego as you see it, because I know you talk about the ego a lot
in this book. Yes, I do, yeah.
How do we reach a space of a healthy celebration of who we are? I say that broadly, a healthy celebration versus an unhealthy obsession with me, that everything that happens is all about me, and also, you know, not even thinking about the people around you, which often can happen. And then also that other part, if you go too far the other way, utterly diminishing yourself, you know, where you are just worthless and you then have no self-esteem at all. So could you approach that for us? Because it's an important area.
Yeah, because this is, of course, what the other insights lead us towards. But I'll try to give a rough and ready version of what the ego is, and then I'll perhaps take you through the other insights to see how this works. You know, we all have egos, and actually we need them, because if you don't have an ego, you won't be able to choose, you know, what breakfast to have, what breakfast to put on the table, or what clothes to wear. An ego says, this is who you are within a certain framework. So I choose, you know, a tie and pants and shoes, etc., that fit the occasion. That ego is not really the problem. What is the problem is what I call the wounded or frightened part of the ego. And that's what we get when we go to school and we discover that we're not as big as Billy or as fast a runner as Sarah, or we can't draw as well as Tommy. And the world of judgment tends to descend on us somewhere around the age of 5, 6, 7. And for some of us, that means that we feel wounded. Oh, I'm not as good as I thought I was. And so we try to overcompensate in other ways. Oh, I'm not good at drawing, but I'm really good at, history.
Writing.
Or writing, yes.
That would be a good one.
Yes, especially writing. And then we say, oh, well, I'm good at writing, and you're not. You know, I'm good at this. And this is the damaged part of ourself that wants to be consoled all the time. That's the damaged part of ourself that wants more toys because they make us feel good. They make us feel temporarily superior to someone else who maybe doesn't have as nice a car or as big a house or as good a job or whatever. In my case, it was the job. I thought, oh, wow, I'm really in a great job here working with these kids. This is a fun, wonderful establishment. What I didn't ask myself was, can you do the job? Is it really true to the best part of you? And actually, I couldn't do the job that well, although I have to say, I learned a huge amount, so I'm forever grateful to them. So this, if that's a rough definition of what the ego is and does, and the dangerous part of it, of the ego, the wounded, damaged, the frightened ego that is constantly grabbing for some sort of reassurance, what the insights show us is how to get rid of that wounded part of ourselves. And when we've reached the place of humility, very quickly upon its heels we get to the third part of the third insight, which is, quite surprisingly to me, is beauty. When we are in a place that is humble and when we're grateful, we can look out at the world and say, oh my goodness, this is a really, really astonishing, beautiful, wonderful world. Even if the view I'm looking at isn't, you know, the Swiss Alps or the Peruvian Andes, it's still a pretty amazing place just to be here. And that sort of appreciation causes us to love the space we're in. And when love starts to grow in that way, we give ourselves an enormous gift. We're not loving ourselves, which is what the wounded ego wants. We're loving the things that are around us. Yes. When we see that beauty, we see the beauty in the face of a child, even if the child isn't very good looking, but the rapport between mother and child is beautiful. When we get to that space, it pushes us very gently towards the fourth insight. And the fourth insight is an awareness that deep inside ourselves, we possess a wonderful sense of purity and innocence. And we might not have met that purity and innocence for many, many, many years. And when we get to that space, we can say, oh, at the core of myself, it doesn't matter how many toys I have, what color my car is, how much I paid for this. What we have is this absolutely authentic sense of honesty and devotion and innocence, and again, love becomes just a little deeper. Imagine the innocence of a child that just loves.
Is this like our inner child that you hear referred to often? How is it related to that?
Well, the inner child is a wonderful concept, but I like to think of this as contacting the same purity as the inner child, except with the added wisdom of the years that we've got.
Yes.
So you don't need to regress.
Yes.
No, it's not a regression. It is a reclaiming of what is essentially ours. So, for example, as I tell some of my my counseling people, I say, you know, you have to get back to the place of innocence and love and trust.
You know, trust, that, yes.
That's what a baby has. And they say, yeah, well, you know, babies aren't much, are they? And I say, yeah, you try having an adult relationship, a successful adult relationship with anybody without love and trust. It's not going to happen. So the innocence and the love and the trust are absolute requirements so we can have a decent relationship with ourselves and others.
When we're in that space, Alan, what do we do and when our trust is violated in some way? You know, I think of a baby in a way in that, you know, they trust so much and then, you know, maybe something goes wrong, you know, at the simplest level where maybe something they want is not available right when they want it or whatever, and they feel, you know, maybe at the simplest of levels there's been a violation of trust. Yeah. What do we do in that situation when are we wide open at that point? Are we unprotected? You know, these are the things that we worry about going to that place. And shall we just not be conscious of that? And can we still be protected in that place?
Yes, well, it's a very good question. We're not unprotected because we don't lose all of our knowledge of the way the world is when we go to this place of trust and love. We become mm-hmm. vulnerable, and we mm-hmm. can choose those people to whom we show our vulnerability. And I think that that is one of the things that we have to learn is, who do I choose to be vulnerable and open with? And if I'm not being respected, then I will quietly withdraw from the space that I'm not being respected and not give people the chance to misuse that trust and that vulnerability. You know, it's not an easy thing to do, and it requires us to be constantly present to the other people in our life. And that means when people are sometimes aggressive towards us, we can choose to react to them and say, well, you know, that's not very nice. Or possibly we can say, oh, wait a second, is this person suffering? And that's why he or she is behaving like that. And if so, what can I do to be more loving and more trusting to this person? They may disrespect us, but we haven't lost anything apart from a little time, perhaps. So that, you know,
Oh, no, I was just going to say, when you speak of that, it just seems sometimes it's so easy. In fact, we go back in this in our mind, and maybe this relates to mind circling, which I also want to ask you about. But, you know, where we're in this cycle of blame, where something happened that was harsh. You know, all of us have had something happen, and, you know, maybe it was due to some interaction that was not good. And we know, at one level, as we're becoming more awakened, you know, I need to get out of this space of saying, you know, why did this person do this to me, or whatever, you know, blame. And yet, you know, how do we get out of that? How do we fully understand, you know, recognize where this person is, and then yet also move on and take responsibility and be in a better space?
Oh, wonderful question. Well, you know, perhaps I would look at that by saying that blame is what the wounded ego does.
Mm-hmm.
The wounded ego doesn't want to be responsible. So it says, look at how nasty these people have been to me. I have every mm-hmm. right to give up trusting them. And believe me, that you know that, I know that, it's very, very common. I deal with my students here on campus. We do courses on what I call therapeutic uses of writing, and the number of people who come into the classroom who have trust issues because of something that has happened to them is just overwhelming. And I say to them, there is only one way to rebuild trust. You learn how to trust by trusting. And so it requires a huge amount of courage for people to choose the moment, step forward and say, I will trust this person, I will trust that person, and I will grow trust in my life. It's not easy, but it has to be done, otherwise we lock ourselves in our own dark, deep dungeon and we refuse to find the key. And that's a pretty sad way to go through life.
Very much so. You know, one of the other things that came to mind, and I'm going to be really honest here, I told you before the show, Alan, that I've been dealing with some things.
Yes,
and this kind of hits on it. And I think we may have to do a whole other show on this particular topic because it relates to writing. But I'm as you're speaking, I'm realizing that one of the reasons I'm having trouble writing, although I seem to be able to do this show, is I am afraid of exposing the level of vulnerability and honesty where I feel that I need to go to authentically write. Unless I'm to create some sort of sham, some surface. I've written plenty of things that I don't feel are authentic, and I'm sure it was a good exercise and all, but I'm not in that place, and it has to do with trust. What do you do as a writer when you are literally throwing open the gates to your most vulnerable self where anyone can enter in? Because, you know, anyone can read the book, And I know, you know, I'm doing it to some degree on this show, but not to the degree that I know I will be brought by some of the things I feel called to write. And so how can you help not just me with this, but I know that this is helping me with this will also help many others who are in the same place. How can we do this? How can we expose who we are and be comfortable
yes.
with that?
Yes, it's a tricky question, isn't it? I would
it
perhaps
is.
say that there is no trickier question, no more challenging question, but it doesn't mean it doesn't have an answer. And here
mm-hmm.
is what I would propose. It seems to me that when we write our most personal stuff, and I can only gauge this by the many people I've worked with and by my own writing,
yeah.
when we write our most personal stuff, that actually is writing that is intended only for our own eyes.
I see.
It is, you may say, the first draft, where we're working out the issues, we're working out the problems. And that's wonderful, but perhaps it's not terribly much use to share that.
Uh-huh.
What is useful is to step back from that writing and say, what are the lessons, what is the wisdom, what are the features of this experience that other people seem to need to know so that they can run their lives better? And at that point, it stops being about my experience, it starts being about the experience that could help others.
Yeah.
And I mention that because, not because I want anyone to disguise anything from anyone, and certainly not because I want people to be inauthentic, but because I think there is a higher purpose in writing for an audience, which is to offer them not just one's heart bleeding on a platter, as it were, but
yeah.
to offer them some place where they can say, oh, this person knows what my heart is. Now I know I'm not alone. Now I know different ways of living. And so it's the difference, I guess, between self-communion and communication. And
uh-huh.
the communication, I think, ultimately is about us, but it's not about us only. It's about what other people may need to know in order that all of our lives can be better.
Okay, that is really helpful, actually, because what probably many of us, including myself, I mean, what we're being called to do is some inner work, essentially,
yes.
is that we're trying, you know, so often we try to rush it. And again, I don't want to digress too much because I sense we're going to have another show on writing. So this will just be kind of a teaser for that show. But I think that it does relate to this topic of being vulnerable, certainly,
yes.
and trust. And, you know, I think that already you have given me some helpful information that sometimes, and in fact, I guess this relates to some other things you have said in other areas where, you know, we think that a certain thing we need to do, like I'm feeling I need to do something with my writing. But
yes.
that doesn't mean that what I need to do with my writing has anything to do with what I need to publish.
Uh-huh.
It may have everything to do with what I simply need to write.
Yes.
Which is quite different. And that's what you
yes.
just told me. And it has to do with becoming much more deeply intimate with myself
yes.
and my journey. And that's what you're saying. And I thank you for that because you actually answered a question that's been troubling me for many days.
Oh, good.
And so we'll move on from that and hold
yeah.
it for
yeah.
a future program for writers,
please.
I hope. and then, you know, continue on with this discussion. Now, I have a question
yeah. Yeah.
with regards to how we get trapped in different things.
Yes.
What is mind circling? I know you refer to that.
Yes.
Can you explain to me what it is and what it does? It have positive and negative aspects? Just explain that whole.
Usually it has. Yes. Usually it has negative aspects. I'm sorry to say.
Okay.
And mind circling. I mean, circling is what we tend to do when we're uncertain about
yes.
anything. And so the example I give is, I don't know, but when I was growing up, one of my favorite books was Winnie the Pooh, A.A. Milne's story of the bear and the piglet. Absolutely charming. And at one time, in one of the occasions that really struck me was that Pooh is going for a walk in the forest, and he comes across a set of tracks. And he thinks, I wonder what these tracks are. And he decides that they must be a Woozle's tracks. So he follows them, and after a while, he sees, wait a second, there are two sets of tracks. He's walking in a circle. And he says, well, maybe there are now two Woozles. And this is when Piglet sees him. And Piglet comes up and says, what are you doing? And Pooh says, well, I'm looking for these Woozles. Do you want to join? And Piglet says, yes. And so the bear and the piglet walk around the stand of trees. And, of course, when they come around again, they say, there's another set of tracks. Well, maybe it's not just two Woozles, but it's two Woozles and a Whizzle. And so they go around again. And each time they go around, there are more tracks. Until finally Pooh says, well, this is very interesting. And Piglet says, I've just remembered something urgent I have to do at home, and runs away. And, as a five-year-old, I laughed at this, how silly this bear and piglet were. And then years later, I said, but that's exactly what adults do. They have a problem. They circle it. And as they circle it with their thoughts, they see, as it were, another set of mind tracks, all the previous thoughts they've had. And suddenly the problem becomes twice as big. And then maybe they have a friend who comes along and says, oh, what's going on? And the friend will be with you a certain amount of the way and then say, this is too scary for me, and run off. And as we circle the problem, just like Pooh, we make more and more tracks, and it becomes more and more scary, and actually we're not getting anywhere. And that's what happens when we put off the discussion with the boss. That's what happens when we say, I can't talk to my kids about this yet. I'll wait till there's the right moment. This is what happens when we refuse to just go to the heart of things and say, this is what I see. Am I right? So circling is what we do on a regular basis, and it really doesn't make life any better, but it does give us a chance to spend many, many hours not doing what we have to do, feeling victimized, gossiping with our colleagues, and not doing what's necessary. It's a very human thing. If you know that you do that, it's time to stop and actually look at the situation anew, and if there's a way forward, then go and do it open-heartedly, not expecting anything. Just say, this is the situation, how can we solve it?
And there's a little discussion in the chat, which I want to try to relate into a question, is if you're in a place of economic hardship, which right now is very, very common. I mean, this is not an easy time. We're doing this show in the middle of the day. I mean, many people listening may very well be unemployed, and not to say that all of them are, but and I can certainly, many of us can relate to this. What do you do? How can teachings of this nature help us when we feel like, you know, we're just focused on our very survival and feeling entrapped, even, you know, entrapped in jobs where you practically feel enslaved, and yet there's a yearning there to apply these teachings. You know, how can we do that? Speaking broadly to any of us when we're in a space, and actually, you know, hardship can hit us in many ways. It doesn't have to be economic. I mean, if your health is taken away, I mean, look at what happened to you. I mean, you could have all the wealth in the world, and you know, if you have a health issue, not to say you had all the wealth in the world.
No, I certainly didn't, actually.
just in general, there are many ways that we can be in a space of genuine hardship, you know, something really challenging going on. And you know, the question is, how can we make this present for us now in helping us when we're in that space?
Yes. Well, I have an enormous amount of empathy and compassion for those who are in that space of hardship, because It is just so grinding, and certainly when I became ill, the story at the start of the book that really precipitated this whole discussion, I found myself at the end of the day without a job, without a home, because my home was linked to my job, without sufficient money, and
yes.
I thought, well, you know, there's not a lot left. Actually, you know, I did have my health back, so I wasn't as badly off as I thought. But saying to myself, gosh, I have my health, and therefore I have possibilities, was enormously consoling to me. Now, very many times I've met people in places of economic hardship, and some of them have felt trapped and ground down and desperate. And
yes.
That is often a reality. And yet I have also met people in places of economic hardship, seem to me equally as bad, who have been able to smile and laugh and extend more love to their sick parents, their sick children. They are ground down, but they're not defeated, because they are building back on the loving connection between people.
Yeah.
Real poverty is a terrible thing, and real poverty can eat away at those connections between people, or sometimes it can help them to grow. And that, to some extent, is a choice that we can make, to some extent.
Yeah.
Now, I can't talk for every person, but
of
to
course.
Some extent we can look at the mother with the three children and she can't feed them enough money and say, oh my God, what a difficult situation. And we can also look at the mother and three children and say, look, she's got her three children. She's not giving them up for adoption. She's fighting for them. And she's teaching them a lesson of deep love and deep compassion that is worth far more than anything I can think of. It's a tough way to get that lesson, but by golly, what a great lesson it is.
Yes. And you know, just to people listening, I mean, I know that, you know, so many of us have gone through challenges. And, you know, one of the things that I've discovered, Alan, is such a sense of empathy. It's as if your eyes just open up to things that you never saw until you experienced, you know, not that I, heaven forbid that all of us must experience every single challenge, although maybe if we believe in reincarnation, we do at some point, but I mean, I don't want to invite that necessarily.
No,
however, I have my own road of you know, often when you choose, for example, to follow the heart,
yes.
you know, which I have done, it has introduced some challenge, which may have been really easy for me in another life when I was an engineer, because I was working a job that did not, I mean, it served me, but it's funny, our paths are parallel in some ways, because I had much the same thing. And, you know, in choosing to be in this space where I am now, you know, I wish I could say that I'm just sitting on the air, you know, because I have all this infinite wealth and can talk all day on Blog Talk Radio, but it's not that way, you know. And so sometimes when, you know, we do make some sacrifices when we choose to be in the heart, and it's not always easy. And
yeah.
And I think that if anything, I have, oh, I've gotten such a sense of empathy. You know, when you're not in a position, for example, to buy everything that shows up on television, you realize, you know, television is incredibly insensitive. You know, even if you just go through a time of hardship and somehow get out of it, which hopefully many of us can, you then realize how insensitive our culture can be, in that so much of the consumer culture speaks only to people very much in a space of ego and trying to impress each other. And it also feels really badly when you're not in that place, unless you can just unveil that, hey, you know, I don't need to have the next best car. And, you know, when maybe you can't have that, you know. And so anyway, empathy, I mean, if anything. But
definitely.
My compassion does go out to anyone out there, because, you know, it's a challenging time right now for many.
Yes.
And
Yes, I can only say that that's absolutely right. And in some ways, that brings me to the fifth of the five insights.
Yeah.
Because the final insight after, you know, after one has got to this place of a real sense of innocence is that one begins to grow one's compassion and one's sense of love to much deeper levels. And
yes.
It's not simply, oh, you know, I love my neighbor. It's not just, oh, I love people who are worthy of love. But we move to a place where we're actually understanding more about who everybody is and what they need. And it brings us very close to what I would call unconditional love. And when we get to that space, we begin to rethink our role in creation. And I call this last insight finding one's place in nature. And that is perhaps a slightly clumsy way of saying we ask the question about ourselves differently. We say, what is it that I am here to learn? And what is it that I am here to do? And I'll give you an example of that, if I could, a very dramatic example. A very interesting gentleman whom I quote in the book called Andrew Biankowski, he wrote his memoir about being taken by the Russians to Siberia at the outbreak of World War II. He was Polish, and being in an internment camp, and how brutally hard that was, and how his grandfather in front of him gave up eating food so the little boys, he and his brother, could have enough food to survive. And there are two ways to take that. One way is to say, what a terrible thing, that should never, ever happen to anyone. And I agree. Mm-hmm. And the other way is to say, that was indeed a heavy, heavy blow. Now, what is it that anyone can take away from that experience which is positive? And Biankowski said he spent 60 years, as a therapist. He said, that's what I call radical gratitude. He says it's being able to be grateful for things even when they're absolutely horrible, because sometimes when things are truly horrible, that's when you can learn the most from them. He has never stopped being profoundly grateful to his grandfather for his grandfather's selfless act. And it really is quite an extraordinary story if you ever read his book. And he's also never stopped realizing that if he had held on to that hurt, he would still be, in his mind, in that concentration camp, instead of which he spent his whole life taking his hurt and turning it into his genius. Where we are hurt is where our genius will be. And he was hurt by this terrible, terrible betrayal by other human beings, and what he discovered was that on the other side of that is the strongest thing of them all, and that's love. And he saw his place in the universe. Going forward, he said, I have to go into the world and work to help people to be more loving to themselves and other people. And I think that is right at the center of the five insights, because when we see that, it's not going to be about us, me, 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 the ego, ever again.
Yeah.
It's going to be about this world needs certain things. How can I apply whatever it is that I am successfully or meaningfully back into the world? And that is a profound lesson that the television doesn't tell you. The television tells you to hanker after a shiny toy, which will make you perhaps feel good about yourself for a little while. And the television is everywhere, and there are, you know, 400 channels or 800 channels, all of them saying roughly the same thing. It doesn't mean they're telling us the truth. It means that we have to be aware of this and say, no, my place in nature is not to amass dollar bills and you know, keep all the goodies for myself. My place, all of our places, are to contribute back, because we've been given this amazing gift. We're alive. We're here. We're now. We can give back. And that's right at the center of the book.
And when you speak of beauty, that is a beautiful concept, Alan, that feeling of wanting to be of service, I guess. is another way, without, not in a disempowering way, in an unconditionally loving way. Because, you know, when you speak, and you know, I referred to that world of the television, it really is an illusion. I mean, although I do sense there is, you know, it can be hurtful sometimes, and it's easy to react to, you know, and to be envious of what you see. What's really on there is an illusion, because all of those possessions don't bring fulfillment. We all know the story of someone who may have, you know, access to anything and yet is miserably unhappy, whether it be even a celebrity or whatever. We don't have to know these people personally. We think we do because of all the things that are out there about them. But, you know, we come full circle here as we're coming into the final minutes of, you know, what does it mean to live a fulfilled life? That illusion that's on the television is not exactly it. And I'm going to give you the opportunity to bring us full circle here. This time has gone by so fast.
It has flown by, hasn't it?
Before I even have you answer that question, for our live audience, again, to learn about Dr. Alan Hunter, you simply go to alanhunter.net. And to learn about this show, I always get cut off, by the way, and I'm going to let you close it with an inspirational thought. You simply go to frontierbeyondfear.com. So those are the two links you need to move on from today's show and learn even more. But please, Alan, do address that in our final moments of where do we bring this to that guidance of leading a fulfilled life?
It's very simple. The book and my own thoughts, of course, lead us only to one place, and that is the place of love. That is what makes for a fulfilled life. That's the only thing that makes for a fulfilled life. It's not self-love, the amassing of objects. It is selfless love, perhaps unconditional love, where we love our human beings, the human beings around us, who are ornery and difficult and nasty and all those things, as well as loving and wonderful, and we love them anyway. And that, it seems to me, is where we need to move towards, because people grow at different rates, and some of them are going to be ornery and unpleasant for a large number of years, and maybe they'll never get to the space we would like them to be. But we've got to love them anyway, because we're on this planet, they're with us, they're around us all the time. So the center of this is, once again, it may sound somewhat cliched, but it's real, profound, unselfish love. Not expecting anything back, not expecting other people to change, not saying, oh, well, if you don't treat me right, I'll stop loving you. You're going to love them anyway, even if perhaps you may have to protect yourself by staying away from them for a while. But love is at the center.
You know, it's that word unconditional. I think it's perhaps one of the most challenging words to fully grasp. No conditions.
No conditions.
That's what you just described. And, you know, I have to say that it leads to a kind of understanding, too, and a kind of, and we even touched upon this in the last show, you know, how can we help things? You know, when something is dysfunctional, and, you know, in the chat they're still talking about the dysfunction in the world. How can we begin to approach a world where those things are in a much better place? And as you say, it's all based in that unconditional love. And I begin to see that too. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, Ram Dass has a wonderful example. He's talking of his guru in India, and he said, it wasn't that the guru loved us unconditionally. That wasn't the center of it. He said it was that whenever we were all in the company of the guru, we all found ourselves loving each other unconditionally. And I think that's a marvelous difference. It's not what we do, it's what we can cause to happen, what we can foster, what we can grow.
Yes, that is That is very powerful.
Yes.
In these final seconds, let me just say thank you,
Alan. Thank you, Susan. This has been such a wonderful conversation. I do so enjoy chatting with you like this.
Oh, and so do I. I truly do. And thank you for being here. And I do look forward to the next time, very much so.
I do, too.
So
yeah.
Thank you for doing all that you're doing in the world. And, you know, we just look forward to seeing what comes next. So.
Well, I will say the same to you. Thank you for doing all that you are doing to bring the words of people like me out into the world so that others can think and ponder and make their own decisions in their own way. I can't imagine more important work than that. Thank you for being you.
I appreciate that. And I am so appreciative in that our paths have crossed. And as such, our paths are crossing with many people out there who are connecting to us. So it's a beautiful thing. And I look forward to seeing its unfolding. So
yes, indeed.
And I guess with that, I will wrap up today's episode. We're now speaking in the podcast, which is fine. Many people will be listening to the podcast as well. And actually, as long as I'm at it, before I stop, I will say welcome to you guys in the podcast. You know, I'm actually going to send you a little bit of unconditional love across time because I'm very much aware of people listening to this show in the future, and I want you to know that I'm conscious of you in the energy of this moment. Do you get what I'm communicating, Alan? I just want them to feel present with us right now. And so thank you to everyone surrounding this show, and thank you, Alan, and I so look forward to the next time. So
much gratitude, and thank you.
All right. Well, take care then.
You too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay, and with that, we will wrap up this episode of the show. Again, if you want to learn any schedule details of both existing podcast shows, and we're getting quite a library now, and also some very interesting upcoming guests, just visit frontierbeyondfear.com, and there you will find links to all of the guest websites, and it's continuing to be enhanced. I will soon have pages for every guest so that you would be able to go to Dr. Alan Hunter's Frontier Beyond Fear page and not only go to his site, but also see all of the shows that he's been on here. And that's one of my goals that I'm actively working on. So I do welcome you at that site. And there's also an opportunity there for you to support the show should you feel called to do so. So thank you again for being here, and I will see you next time.